Number one, before we understand why change happens, we need to realize that sometimes something which is good for me might be bad for someone else. So what happens is, I may face a hardship that may cause someone else ease. This is explained beautifully by our fifth Imam, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. In one of the stories that he tells his companions, he says that during the time of the Bani Israel, there was a man who had two daughters. One daughter was married to a farmer, and one daughter was married to a potter who used to make pots. And when he went to his first daughter's house, who was married to a farmer, the daughter tells him, "Oh my father, pray to Allah to send rain so that the farm can thrive, so that the crops can grow." And so then he goes to visit his second daughter, and the second daughter says, "Oh father, pray to Allah to bring sunshine and no rain, so that the pots that my husband has made can dry and that we can make money by selling the pots." On the one hand, the father is asked by one daughter, "Pray for rain." The other daughter says, "Pray for sunshine." The father says, "Oh Allah, whatever is best, you decide. At the end of the day, one thing is good for you is bad for someone else. One thing is bad for that person is good for you." So there is this difference. And Allah Azza wa Jal caters for all His servants. Now, once we have understood this, why does change happen? One reason is that a change in your fortunes can be the result of something that you did in the past. You might have done something to someone in the past, and now you are suffering the consequences. If you have done something bad, you might be suffering the consequences of what you have done. There was a king who was very, very just and very fair. And at that time, obviously it was, and it is generally not common to have a king who is very fair and very just. And so the people would ask him, "How is it that you are such a fair king? This adl that you have, this justice." He said, "I learned it from something that I witnessed in my life. One day I was going out on a hunting trip, and I noticed that after shooting a deer, when my dog, hunting dog, went to that deer to catch the deer, it broke the leg of that deer out of cruelty. After a little while, I saw that that very same dog was stepped on by a horse and its leg got broken. A short while later, I saw that that very same horse fell in a pit and broke its leg. So I realized this cannot be a coincidence. The dog broke the leg of the deer, the horse broke the leg of the dog, and the horse leg also got broken. So there is a system of giving and receiving. You get back what you have put in. If you do good, you get back good. If you do evil, you get back evil." So that is one possibility when you see there is change in fortune. Now, for example, things are not working out. Before, everything was going well. Now everything is going bad. It could be, one of the reasons could be, that you are getting back what you did in the past. The result and the consequence of what you have done in the past. And of course, that is why one of the advantages of giving sadaqah, as we mentioned, is when you give sadaqah, you are helping someone out. There is benefit to it. You yourself will benefit from giving the sadaqah. Sallu ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. So that is number one, something that you did in the past. Number two, it could be a test from Allah Azza wa Jal, a change in fortunes. It is a test. And of course, for believers, tests are part and parcel of life. And the higher you are in terms of your belief, the harder the tests get. That is why the Prophet said, نحن معاشر الأنبياء أشد الناس بلاءً. We the prophets, we face the hardest tests from Allah Azza wa Jalla. Why? Because they are the topmost people. So as you are a believer, if you your iman grows, then expect that the tests from Allah will grow. And one way that Allah tests you is by changing your fortunes. One day you are doing well in your business, the next day you are not doing well. And so this is a change in fortunes that happens. So the second possible reason for this change is a test. The third is that it is a natural change that happens. Can't do anything about it. وَمَن نُعَمِّرْهُ نُنَكِّسْهُ فِي الْخَلْقِ أَفَلَا يَعْقِلُونَ. Those whom we give longer lives, there as they grow older, when they reach a certain age, now it starts working in reverse. نُنَكِّسْهُ فِي الْخَلْقِ. You know, there was an old man who once came to give a talk in a gathering, and he said that I want to tell you about old age. Telling the people, I want to tell you about old age. When you grow old, three things happen. Number one, you lose your memory. And two and three, I can't remember. Sallu ala Muhammadin wa ala Muhammad. So it could be a natural change in your life that happens, like old age, for example. And the third possible reason for change, or the fourth possible reason for change in fortunes, is what we see from the riwayat, that such change remove arrogance from people. A beautiful hadith tells us, لولا ثلاثة ما وضع ابن آدم رأسه لشيء. Had it not been for three things, the human being would not lower his head for anything. Number one, al-faqr, poverty. Number two, al-marab, sickness. And number three, al-maut. Were it not for these three things, human beings would not lower their heads for anything. So, because of the change in circumstances, because of poverty, because of sickness, because of death, human beings are now humble. It removes arrogance from their hearts. So these are the reasons why change happens. Now, once change happens, how do you react to change? You react to change in different ways, but there are certain things you need to keep in mind. Number one, never complain. A beautiful tradition says, لَا خَيْرَ فِي عَبْدٍ شَكَى مِنْ مِحْنَةٍ تَقَدَّمَهَا آلَافُ النِّعْمَةِ وَأَتْبَعَهَا آلَافُ الرَّاحَةِ. There is no good in a servant who complains about one hardship that has been preceded by so many blessings, thousands of blessings. Allah Azza wa Jal has given you thousands of blessings, and now one hardship comes and you start complaining. Obviously not. That is the wrong way to react to this change in fortune. The second way, the second thing that you need to know about when it comes to reacting to change in fortunes, is that Allah has blessed us with the ability to adapt. So adapt. If you are now facing a different kind of life than what you had in the past, you need to adapt. If you are very well off and now you are poor, then you need to remove some of the extravagant expenses that you had. For example, Khalil Gibran has a very interesting analogy, an interesting analogy regarding this adaptation. He says, the fox came out in the morning, early in the morning, and saw its long shadow. And it said to itself, today I will eat a camel. As it tried hunting and hunting, and it was unsuccessful, when noontime came and it looked at its shadow, now the shadow has become so small, the fox said, even a mouse will do. In the morning, camel, now even mouse. So adaptation. And the final point we want to mention is that remember, when it comes to these changes in fortune, Allah Azza wa Jal has decided. And if you are a believer, Allah does what is best for you. Allah loves the believers. When He was talking to Musa alayhi salam, He says, Ya Musa, inna ahabba al-khalq ilayya abdi al-mu'min. The most beloved of creatures to me is my believing servant. Abtalihi bima huwa khayrun lah. I only give him trials and tests that are good for him. We pray to Allah Azza wa Jal to grant us the ability to understand that whatever happens in our lives is good for us as believers, and we should bear it with patience. Inshallah, oh Allah, help us to gain as much as we can in terms of self-reform and becoming better human beings, better believers. رَبَّنَا تَقَبَّلْ مِنَّا إِنَّكَ أَنْتَ السَّمِيعُ الْعَلِيمُ وَتُبْ عَلَيْنَا إِنَّكَ أَنْتَ التَّوَّابُ الرَّحِيمُ بِرَحْمَتِكَ يَا أَرْحَمَ الرَّاحِمِينَ رَحِمَ اللَّهُ مَنْ قَرَأَ الْفَاتِحَةَ.
الله أكبر لا إله إلا الله.
الله أكبر. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. الله أكبر.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Dark Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Shadow World, directed by Johan Grimman Prez. And joining me in the studio, we have Maria Duarte, who is a film critic for the Morning Star newspaper and who has also worked as a news journalist. And beside her is Tete Kofi, who is a journalist and broadcaster. Now, Shadow World gives you an alarming behind-the-scenes tale of the global arms trade, revealing the complicity of the US and British governments working with corrupt regimes in the world and how this determines economic and foreign policies, undermines democracy, and creates widespread suffering. And in shedding light on how our realities are being constructed, the film also offers a way for audiences to see through this horror in the hopes of creating a better future.
I've got nothing against money. I don't mind paying bribes to politicians. The thing about politicians is that they're very much like prostitutes, but only more expensive.
The heads of government are the salespeople in chief of their country's large arms contractors.
For the last 50 years at least, policy has been made based on the assumption of greed, and it's ruined the world.
This very phrase, war on terror, it's nonsense. It's like saying a war on war. You're slipping into this possibility of kind of perpetual war.
The national security state not only seeks a perpetual state of war, it will even go to all ends to create that.
They make the mafia look like a bunch of schoolboys.
And it destroys diplomacy. It destroys the will to diplomacy, and it destroys the skill for diplomacy.
Bombs, they're like food. Munitions, that's got, you know, sell-by date. You gotta get rid of it.
Blair came to South Africa to lobby that BAE, the British weapons manufacturer, won the biggest contract, $10 billion, quite scarce public resources, on this weaponry that we didn't need.
BAE had channeled international covert payments all over the world to the local politicians.
Seems to be a very expensive way of organising bribe payment. Might as well cut out the military equipment and just hand out the money.
It's the disease of permanent war that destroys. Islamic fundamentalism.
Companies are not only sort of part of the government, but they're effectively above the law.
It's okay to kill from a distance without a warrant, without a trial, without a jury, and the execution takes place on screen.
Once you start a war, you open a kind of Pandora's box. You don't control it, it controls you. And it propels you in directions you never thought you'd go.
Well, first of all, a very warm welcome to you both. Thanks very much for coming on. So this documentary was a very politically charged film and also quite very eye-opening and covers a lot of ground about the global arms industry, which is a trillion-dollar industry. Maria, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Shadow World?
Well, it's a very detailed, comprehensive look at the exploration of the arms deal, which seems to rally its audience into political action. I didn't feel that it did anything particularly shattering, but what it did was it kind of crossed the T's and dotted the I's. And then it also tried to be a bit sort of poetic. So you have all these numerous talking heads, but they're peppered with these poetic and melodic extracts from Eduardo Galeano's stories. And in that way, the filmmaker trying to make it somewhat more cinematic, because it is a lot to digest.
And of course, it could serve as a comprehensive guide to those who don't know much about this topic.
No, exactly. It's not quite the idiot's guide to arms deal, but it is very intelligently done, very exquisitely edited. And it does give you sort of a very potted history at the issues behind it.
And Tete, if I could turn to you now, what was your take on this film?
Well, trying to understand the arms industry and actually the way of real politics today without watching this film is like trying to understand Hamlet without a crib sheet. You don't understand the language, you don't understand the idioms, you don't understand the context within which everything is being done, and so you probably won't have comprehension. I found this
film... Of course,
film,
that's a lot to ask to squeeze into a 90-odd minute film.
Well, and I always ask myself first, look, did he need 90 minutes? And I think, yes, he did, and he used the 90 minutes extremely well, because ultimately, for any cinematic experience, I'd walk away with, what was the impact? The impact was, I'm really pleased I had breakfast before I watched this movie, because I felt a little bit dirty after watching it. A little bit like
watching...
And why
was that?
Yeah. Because all of it was so kind of resonant with me of why things are in the world they are today. And it's happening in broad daylight.
And of course, you were saying how there were talking heads in this, but they weren't just any talking heads.
No.
They were very high-profile interviews. We had top journalists like Robert Fisk, senior American politicians...
Yes, and you also had that arms dealer, which apparently was very difficult to get hold of an arms dealer to come into the film, because the director said that the first rough cut was 4.5 hours long, and he'd interviewed 50 people and kind of condensed it to 15. But with people like that arms dealer, it kind of adds colour, because at the end of the day, they are just talking heads.
Mm. I mean, at the beginning, what absolutely got me bolt upright was a banal statement like, actually, when you're doing an arms deal, your secretary's ass could give you the edge. Then later on in the clip you showed, where he said that politicians are like prostitutes, it's just that they're a little bit more expensive. It's the banality of that world which actually ordinary people in the street cannot believe can be happening in the world of multimillion dollar corporations and the heads of state who we voted to put in place.
Mm. So Shadow World's an apt name indeed for the documentary.
This is an impressive crowd, the haves and the have-mores.
Cheney commissioned a study by Halliburton to find out how much more of the Defense Department could be privatized.
Halliburton, proud to serve our troops.
Halliburton was elated to get this $1 million contract, and of course returned a verdict that, oh, Mr. Secretary, lots more of it can be privatized.
Dick Cheney leaves the Defense Department and goes and heads Halliburton himself, and he spends the entire 1990s building up the Halliburton war empire.
Well, if we're going to talk about Star Wars, we might as well invite Darth Vader. I'm happy to accept.
Then he comes back into power as vice president, and then they start hiring Halliburton to, you know, in advance even of U.S. troops going into Iraq, Halliburton personnel and equipment was being deployed to the Gulf. It's hard to look at this and not say these guys had a very long-term plan for how they were going to increase the powerful infrastructure of private companies. what we've essentially done is to create a network of corporations that have the firepower of small nation states that could, you know, overthrow some small governments around the world.
In essence, we in the United States have privatized the ultimate public function, war.
After watching this documentary, really, you believe there's no such thing as coincidences. Maria, what was your reaction to watching the connections being made between the US military, the government, and oil companies? And what else does the documentary suggest about the ulterior motives of the government?
Well, part of me was shocked. Part of me was resigned to this hideous, dark shadow world as it's described, and that we have no power to do anything about it because all this is done behind closed doors, you know. It's all about sweeteners and kickbacks. And as it said in the film, that war is a commodity, and it doesn't matter how many people die, the longer that lasts, the more money people make, whether it be at the top of government or, you know, these arms dealers. Mm-hmm. It's disgusting. It's appalling, and you do feel dirty afterwards, but you kind of feel powerless. And the film doesn't really give you an alternative.
Perhaps there is no alternative in real life, though.
Maybe not. Of course, now with the Trump administration, we would hope that there isn't that secrecy because he does everything via Twitter, and we have the biggest arms deal. I'm putting that in inverted commas because he hasn't said that. But you know, in the Reagan era and Thatcher and all of those, it was all done secretively.
Which is highlighted in the documentary.
Yeah, and even up to Obama, which that was quite surprising, but not, because it's government, so they can do whatever they want, really.
And Tete, if I could turn to you, would you agree with what Maria said, and what did you make of these connections being made?
Very much. I mean, I split the movie, the doc, into three parts. Part one was the arrogant vulgarity and banality of it, with the arms dealer making those statements about politicians and prostitutes, things like that. The bit where they showed a whole Saudi sultan being given a commercial airliner, and the banality of him painting it in his favourite American football colours. I mean, if I was a Man U supporter, I'd have liveried it up in red, for example. Then the second part is that it goes into the culture and the rationales which are given to enable this to happen, and the institutions that support that culture, which is what we've just basically watched. Now, I could not help but expand this documentary into history. And I place at the start point towards the civilization we have now reached at the start of the transatlantic slave trade. Because this was the first time an activity, slavery, has been known since the dawn of civilization, but this was the first time it was actually industrialized. Mm-hmm. And with the industrialization, you had to create a philosophy and a culture which enabled it to go on, fly in plain sight with the support of ordinary people. And this is the bit that this documentary does so extremely well.
Well, that's a fascinating point.
I denounced the call to invade Iraq publicly. The New York Times issued me a formal written reprimand, which is what you get before you're fired under union rules to stop speaking out against the war. I'd been the Middle East bureau chief. I mean, I'd been in Iraq, been 7 years in the Middle East. How can you come out of Gaza and not be angry? What's being done to those people? How can you come out of the Sudan, El Salvador, dozens of other places I've been and not be angry? I've seen the bodies of a lot of children, which I can't forget. Especially having done it for 20 years, Dostoevsky said, hell is the inability to love, and that's what kills people. I fully get why people blow their brains out. It's really hell. And I don't use love as a kind of hallmark, schmaltzy, you know, we all gotta love each other. I'm saying that the only way you're healed from those experiences is by reestablishing a connection with that kind of power, with another human being. And if you can't do that, you don't survive. And I have friends who couldn't do it, and they're not here anymore.
Very emotional account there. Maria, do you get a sense from this documentary that there is a lot of frustration and a lack of support for these ongoing wars?
Well, there is, but the problem is, and what the governments do so insidiously is to instill terror and fear into the populace. And so that gives them carte blanche to do what they want militarily. And so people sort of believe what the government tells them. And so we're in this vicious circle that correspondents, brave correspondents, like you've just seen, try to get the truth out there. And they're literally, you know, smacked down, and they try to gag them. Mm. And that's appalling, and it shouldn't happen, but it does, and it's still happening today.
Mm. And this reminds me, actually, Claire Short, former Labour politician, she says that the war on terror is sort of almost like a manufactured concept to keep this sort of perpetual wars, and it's sort of used as a scapegoat. Would you agree with that, Teddy?
Well, a marketing man's dream is a product that creates demand for itself. It becomes a perpetual motion machine, and you can't stop it. And I call this part of the documentary the state capture bit. That's the expression we actually use in South Africa for when private people latch onto the state and leech off it. Because that's what's happened with the arms companies and their lobbyists, is that actually they are running the state. And that's why that arms dealer can say that the politicians don't run anything, they're just more expensive than prostitutes. It's the banality of that. And I think that at the end, this documentary works because of the sense of outrage. It can fire up in people. Some people will also just feel, what's the point? I give up. We don't stand a chance. But many, many people will be outraged just by being able to join the dots of the fact that these private contractors have got a stranglehold on government. And actually what government does is as a result of what is profitable to the contractor. And some of the governments, of course, people are corrupt. Imagine the ANC taking that massive... the African National Congress. Yeah. Taking that massive kickback when hundreds of thousands of poor, ordinary Africans' lives could have been saved with retroviral drugs. Mm-hmm. But they went for that because the ANC wanted to stay in power.
Well, going back to the documentary and a really fascinating point you made, there's four main targets, I suppose, of the documentary seems to be the US, the UK, Saudi Arabia and Israel. How are the four countries portrayed in this documentary, Maria, and how are they connected?
Well, they're not portrayed terribly well, really, because they're in it for the money. You've seen Blair, who brought in New Labour and was, you know, the spiritual light here who's going to bring all this hope. And yet, you know, he was in it for the money. He was getting, kickbacks and stuff, allegedly. But what was interesting there is that the influence that the Saudi royal family had on him, and where you have Prince Bandar come over and say, hold on, the serious fraud...
Serious fraud office, I believe.
Sorry, having this investigation into these crimes, and they were getting very close to him, and he said, no, you need to stop this, otherwise we're going to remove the security, and there's going to be blood on the streets of London. And then you have Blair turning round, and basically the guy says, jump, and Blair says, well, how high, more or less. That's disgusting, really.
And he
got away with it, but then he was, you know. Teflon Toda, you know, nothing stuck to him. And it's the same with all the other countries. You know, what surprised me was that they didn't look at the drone warfare, which is, and also cyber warfare, which is now becoming...
The documentaries in their own right.
Exactly, and we've probably covered that already. But the thing is that all these countries, nothing kind of surprised me about it, that they were all interlinked. They don't come out very well from the documentary, and they... you didn't think well of them, then it will compound what you thought. It's speaking to the converted, really.
Fiscal year 1999, $2.3 trillion missing. Fiscal year 2000, $1.1 trillion missing. The Pentagon has claimed year after year that the reason it can't account for the money is because its computers don't communicate with each other.
$1 trillion $1 bills stacked high would reach nearly 68,000 miles into space, one-third of the way to the moon.
I got a phone call from the FBI saying that I was a target of a death threat. And that's what happens when you go against the big boys.
Who has the contracts today to make those systems communicate with each other? And how much have the taxpayers paid for them?
There are times that corporations do things they should not do, in which case they tend to be suspended for some period. There are times then that corporations can get out of the penalty box, if you will.
This company was never in the penalty box. If you could proceed to my second question, please.
The second question, I've forgotten what the second question was.
Individuals operating in the shadows and never having their names called are able to leverage the power of the military and the foreign policy apparatus for their own personal pecuniary ends.
What now? Who's the enemy? How do we justify? What better new enemy than an hypothetical, invisible enemy called the War on Terror?
Rumsfeld looked quite smug and incompetent there. Maria, I heard you laugh during that clip. Why was that?
Because he wasn't incompetent. He knew exactly what he was doing and he knew he could get away with it. And he has. You know, it was the one that was then ostracised and found it very difficult later on in her career. So these people get away with it. That's the problem. And it's wrong. But what can you do? What can we do?
And Tete, would you agree with Maria? How do you think of how Rumsfeld was portrayed in this documentary, and was it accurate depiction?
Well, funny thing, when I was watching it, I actually thought it took me back to one of the scenes in the Godfather movies when the mafia bosses are lined up in front of I think it was a grand jury or a commission of some sort, and the smugness with which they behave literally said that whoever's asking the questions, I own your boss. So, and it's the confidence of knowing that he could pull her leash in at any time he wanted. And sure enough, she's got death threats by the FBI. Whether they're true or false, it's almost lethal pressure to make sure that these people comply. It's extremely difficult. But I actually feel that you can over-egg the pudding to a point. And with the confluence of certain events in world affairs, the nationalism that's rising in Europe, Brexit that's happened in Britain, Trump and all the excesses that he is associated with, I think actually we have reached a turning point in which many of these old ways will not be able to function in the way they did before.
So this documentary raises greater and greater questions and makes us question society. Do you think this is a testament to the documentary then, Maria?
I think so. Like I said earlier, it doesn't really reveal anything new, but
it's certainly thought-provoking.
But it's thought-provoking, and it makes you think, and it kind of joins all the dots, basically, because we knew all this. But when you see it there in black and white or in colour, it's slightly different, and it does make you really angry. You know, you end up screaming at the screen because it's so frustrating that these people, on the face of it, got away with it.
Just your final thoughts on the film?
But you see, the interesting thing is that there is another documentary that follows this, which will have to put the last piece of the jigsaw in place, which is that actually our collective standard of living is built on the excesses we're seeing in this movie. And it is, I think, when that story is told, the people will connect the fact that actually there isn't so much of an otherness around somebody who behaves like a gangster in creating public policy, and the car that I'm driving on the street, and the fact that my salary is what it is. All of this thing has a cyclical kind of connection, and people will start to join those dots as well.
We're a very powerful note to end it on, and I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there as we've run out of time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you both to my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام صلة الأرحام تزكي الأعمال وتنمي الأموال وتدفع البلوى وتيسر الحساب وتنسئ في الأجل.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, maintaining relations with one's kin purifies one's actions, brings about an increase in wealth, repels misfortunes, is the account on the day of resurrection, and delays one's appointed time of death.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We find a very interesting and beautiful dialogue between one of the students of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam and Imam Baqir alayhi salam himself. Now, this dialogue is quite long and vast and expansive, but we have decided to just bring out certain pieces from this beautiful dialogue. So Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, he supplies certain eternal and immortal commandments to one of his most knowledgeable students by the name of Ja'far bin Yazid al-Ju'fi. Now in this discussion, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, he talks about certain commandments, certain sayings, which are full of high moral standards and incredibly beautiful ideals through which a human being can become sublime and perfect if they put them into effect. Now, the following is just some of these commandments which Imam al-Baqir gives to Jabir bin Yazid al-Ju'fi in this dialogue. Imam al-Baqir says, think of what they say against you. If you know that what they say against you is really what you are, then do not be angry about the truth. For to become low with Allah the Great and Almighty is more disastrous than to become low with the people. And if you are contrary to the things which they say against you, then you obtain a reward while your body does not become tired. Now here we find again, dear brothers and sisters, that Imam al-Baqir gives us these golden pieces of advice via this dialogue with one of his most knowledgeable students by the name of Jabir bin Yazid al-Ju'fi. And so what does Imam al-Baqir tell us? He tells us that when people say something against you, think about what they're saying. And if what they are saying is true, for example, they say you are stingy, or you are greedy, or you are arrogant, think about what they're saying. And if these things are true regarding yourselves, then first of all, don't be angry. And second, do something to change this thing about you. And remember, if these kind of negative qualities are true, then surely in front of Allah Almighty, we will be answerable. And on the other hand, if these things that they are saying against you are not a part of you, then you obtain a reward from Allah for being patient. And furthermore, when you don't get angry, when you don't get frustrated, when you don't get anxious, then your body, your mind, and your soul do not get tired. Beautiful words in this dialogue between one of the most knowledgeable students of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam by the name of Jabir bin Yazid al-Ju'fi and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam himself. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Just to let you know that when you hear these fatwa from our mujtahideen, you know, people ask this question, oh, mujtahids are giving fatwa, where does it come from? Well, the fatwa in most cases basically are based on the ahadith of the imams of the Ahlul Bayt. Or even if it's not exactly from the wordings of the ahadith, it is based on the principles derived from the Quran and the ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt. Let me go to one more hadith on this line, which is a very lengthy one, but a very interesting one from Usul Kafi. And this is about the issue of a renet. It's not a modern mas'ala. It's a very, very old mas'ala. You know, the enzyme used in yogurt and things like that. You know, if the enzyme comes from the pig, it's basically known as pepsin. And that's obviously haram. But if that same enzyme, which works in the same way, and it is found mostly in yogurt, if it comes from the stomach of the calf or the cow, it is known as renet or rene, in English or French, whatever you want to be. Okay? When it comes to rennet, even if it comes from a cow which was not slaughtered according to Islamic rulings, it is halal and pak. It's not a new fatwa. It's not a new mas'ala. If you look at the books of, you know, our mujtahideen, you will see when they talk about maita, dead body of an animal, you will see there is something which is known as mustasnayat, exemption to the rule of najasat. And in that list you have something known as anfaha or minfaha in Arabic, or in the older Arabic it's known as infaha, which is that enzyme known as renet, which comes from the cow or the calf, the stomach of it. Even if it's not slaughtered according to Islamic rulings, that anfaha is exempted from the ruling of najasat.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful. This is Muslim Lady on IRIB English Radio. And our information is based on tradition. In our previous program, we talked about a woman being a role model for her children. And inshallah, today we have our guest speaker, Sister Salma Khalfan, who in fact is my aunt. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, my dear. Thank you so much for having me over. It's so nice to discuss about, you know, women in hadith.
Very true. Yeah. We're very happy to have you here. So, in our previous program, we talked about women and how they're supposed to be dignified and honored and their station is so high. And you told us some beautiful ahadith about that. So, today, what ahadith do you have in store for us?
Today I have a wonderful hadith of the Holy Prophet of Islam, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, that he said, "Your best women are chaste women, who protect their bosoms and are shameful from the na-mahram, from the strangers in men." So I want to talk about modesty on women. It's very important, you know, because a woman is a woman when she epitomizes that modesty in her. And even if you go and see when she's praying, she's supposed to wear her hijab. Yeah. Whereas Allah is not mahram for her. Allah is the most mahram for her.
Because otherwise we would always have to be in hijab.
Or we should not. We could not tell our secrets to Allah,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Mahram are the ones who share secrets. So who are the ones? Like mahram in the home are the father, the brother, the uncle, you know, from both sides, mother and father. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the most mahram of all. But here Allah wants to see her in that dress of modesty, which makes a woman to be a woman. So here the best women are the most chaste women who protect their bosoms and are shameful from all the na-mahram.
So I guess we have to try and instill this fact that if we want to become perfect, then we should know that there are some things that are good for us, even if sometimes, unfortunately, because of the Western media, because of the West and modernism and all of this, it's trying to show us that if we show ourselves more, that is you know, perfection. That is what we should do.
Yeah.
But
unfortunately, yeah, modesty is out of this chapter.
Yeah, how to instill this modesty?
They think modesty is like, you know, when you earn a reputation,
yeah,
and you earn a profession, things like that. Only that.
Yeah.
Modesty is not shown in all the corners of their life. It's just in one part, your profession. But in Islam wants everywhere,
yeah,
a woman to excel physically, mentally,
and
spiritually.
And they feel this physical modesty that we're talking about is in fact where we're just fooling ourselves. Yeah. In reality, that this
taking
is
taking away the freedom.
The
right?
freedom,
unfortunately,
exactly.
Unfortunately. They don't know the principle of neutralization between men and women so that she can come out as a human being,
yeah,
not a commodity.
Definitely.
Yeah? So this is like Shaheed Mutahari put it so beautiful, that hijab is to neutralize the sexuality of a woman so that her real worth is not on account of her beauty and her charm. It's on account of her personality.
Yeah, and her beauty and charm should be left for her husband.
In fact, it will become more,
yeah,
right? Hijab makes it more because of that nuraniyat, that light that comes in her heart, which shines on her face.
And if she covers it and leaves it and shows it to her husband only, her husband will only want it from her. He will not go looking for it from other people.
Absolutely. So maintaining chastity does not belong to a specific time only, so that girls pay more attention before marriage and do not care about it after the marriage. As in some societies, it was pretended that girls should pay more attention to modesty. When they become, you know, married women, it's okay. That's not the case here.
Yeah.
In every step of life, you know, Islam wants that a woman should be very chaste and modest. And you go and see, Islam talks about it in many ahadiths, her voice, and then it discourages the non-mahram to say salam to a woman. Because salam is the opening of a conversation, a warm opening, yeah? So it doesn't
Which
want
is
that
not one. Necessary.
It's not necessary. So you can directly say, what were you up to, or what is the things that require to be
the
done?
The necessary conversation.
Yeah, necessary conversation, exactly. That doesn't lead to any kind of immoral behavior.
Definitely.
This haya and modesty is so important that we see it citing in other traditions also from the infallible imams. Like Imam Ja'far Sadiq alayhi salam says, there is no faith. Actually, iman is mentioned. There is no faith for those who don't have this modesty and shame.
Oh, subhanAllah.
There is no faith for those who don't have this modesty and shame. This is mentioned in Al-Kafi.
So it's showing the importance of haya.
Yeah, and it shows that the branch of that faith is haya.
Yeah.
That faith is not counted without haya. You know, haya cannot only be extended in this kind of haya. If you go and see, modesty is there, prevalent in every human being. It should be there. Even if we are near Allah, we should be modest in the sense that we should not do something to displease Him.
Yeah.
Like that ayah that mentions, Alam ya'alam bi anna Allah yara. It's a very favorite ayat of mine, one of the favorites. Then don't you know Allah is looking at
you? It's a very beautiful
So life. It's like we should feel ashamed. Here's someone who's looking at you. Even if a small child comes here, can we do something immoral near him? We'll
feel
ashamed.
Shy.
Yeah, we'll feel ashamed. So this is innate in us, but we have to excel in it. We have to keep on building that faith by building the modesty.
Alhamdulillah. So most of the Shias right now, they love Imam Rida, especially over here in Iran. I feel like if you just feel Imam Rida is watching me right now, I'd feel so shy. Allah is watching you.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, Imam Zamana is watching me.
Yeah.
Allah is so merciful. He still forgives and He says, don't worry, there are chances for you to improve. He's the all merciful and He's, you know, still forgiving us and giving us more chances. So faith in the individual sphere is necessary condition for the formation of a religious government. Iman is very important to get this religious government, community, spirit and everything. And modesty is directly related to faith.
Oh.
The condition for the establishment and survival of religious government depends on the modesty of individual members of the society.
Okay.
Every member, be it men or women. Here we are exclusively talking about women, but we are now even dealing with men in a way that haya and modesty should also be in men in every way, you know, that like for example, not sinning. So that haya is built more, that feeling ashamed of the one who gave you all the ni'mat and still going about to go against the commandments of For example, Allah.
And I feel like we should always feel the shame. If we stop feeling the shame, there is a problem. It's unfortunate that some people, they have killed the shame. So now they're so used to doing things like the way they are doing that they don't even care anymore, which is such a pity.
It's such a pity, really.
My Lord, show me right from wrong. Give me light, make me strong. I know the road is long. Make me strong. Sometimes it just gets too much. I feel that I've lost touch. I know the road is long. Make me strong.
Now, you know, when we talk about shame and modesty, it's different from shyness, mind you.
Okay.
Shyness is a good character. You shouldn't talk to everyone. You should feel some shyness should be there in you. Every irreligious human being can be like ashamed or shy. But modesty is a matter of faith and belongs to a religious and believing person.
Okay.
Imam Ali says in one of the hadith about the ratio of modesty and faith. So he says the modesty is a tree whose root is certainty. Its branch is piety and its blossom and fruits are modesty.
Wow.
Yeah. So faith is a tree. Huh? It's like a strong tree whose root is that yaqeen that you have. The branch is, it gives rise to piety. When the piety becomes more, it blossoms into modesty.
Modesty.
Yeah. So it's very much related to the faith. So religious people are modest people too.
Yeah.
Anybody who claims to have faith has to have the modesty.
And appreciating this modesty is very important. I feel like right now you just don't see this modesty anymore. I feel people aren't aware of what is modesty and how and why it's important.
Yeah. You have to look at it properly, thoroughly, psychologically, philosophically. And there's a wide variety of books.
Yeah.
The exposure of books are very widely. For example, I would mention alislam.org has Sheikh Mutahari's philosophy behind hijab. That explains very nicely how hijab came about, why modesty, what is the modesty of the eyes, what is the modesty of men, what is the modesty of the speech.
Yeah, and this physical modesty. And I feel like, unfortunately, right now, the women, they feel at once, if you give them the thing that, oh, about the sweet rapper, that, oh, if you see a sweet which has a wrapper and a sweet without a wrapper, which one would you pick? You'd say, oh, I want the sweet with the wrapper. So they don't want these kind of...
Yeah, they don't like that.
They don't like this. They're
in
like,
fact,
oh,
we shouldn't compare that.
Yeah.
Also.
Yeah. So they're like, don't give us these examples. We don't want to hear this. We have to find a different way of, portraying this beauty of modesty and why it's important.
Yeah.
This has
Look
to
at
be,
it intellectually, right?
Yeah.
Like the nature for women is, how we can prove this instinct of modesty in her is that... when we want to say why a woman has to wear the hijab, especially portraying this modesty in her, then we can relate it in this way that, if a woman goes too far in beautifying herself and self-decorating herself, she gradually reaches the point where she is never satisfied of it.
Oh.
So she keeps on doing more and more of it because it's an innate quality in